From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. The House will vote later today on whether to strip Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene of her committee assignments. This after the House Minority Leader, Republican Kevin McCarthy, chose not to discipline her. Greene is a Trump supporter who has espoused debunked conspiracy theories. A video recently surfaced of her threatening top Democrats in 2018 and 2019. NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell joins us now. Kelsey, today's vote is unusual. What are you expecting to happen?
Yeah, it is extremely unusual. It's actually unprecedented for the majority party to move to take a minority party member off of a committee. What we're expecting is that there will be a party line vote. Potentially, maybe some Republicans will join, but it's not very much expected that that will happen. Republicans say that, you know, there's nothing stopping them from doing the same thing to Democrats down the line if Republicans retake control of the House. They say that it's not appropriate for the House Democrats to be removing somebody for actions taken before they were elected. That's the general argument that you'll hear from Republicans.
I see. And we did hear that Congresswoman Greene addressed her Republican colleagues yesterday. What did she tell them? I mean, did she actually come out and say that some of these conspiracy theories that she's been spouting are wrong?
We know that the Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, says that she acknowledges that she needs to hold herself to a higher standard than she did when she was a private citizen. But we don't know that she said anything publicly. She has not said anything publicly to distance herself from those previous views, though Republicans say that they have spoken with her and that she has attempted to do so in private.
Well, that's interesting because there does seem to be this sort of split maybe between what she's saying publicly and privately, because she's been fundraising and tweeting publicly about this controversy a lot. In fact, today she tweeted that, quote, the D.C. swamp and the fake news media are attacking me because I am not one of them. I'm one of you and they hate me for it. So how does that line up with what we know about what she says behind closed doors?
Well, part of what's happening here is that we've heard her say that she raised $160,000 one day and then $100,000 the following day. She has been sending out fundraising asks about this, but she hasn't spoken to reporters about it. She has not addressed even the House Rules Committee that held a hearing on the motion to remove her from the committee. She did not appear at that hearing. So we really haven't heard her address the allegations or the statements or the videos or any of her actions online in any way that were she would be addressing the public and not just other Republicans. We'll say that this plays into a broader theme that we're seeing, including from Kevin McCarthy, where there's an attempt by Republicans to kind of reframe what's happening here as not about how Republicans are handling the question of conspiracy theories like QAnon and other conspiracy theories that have been kind of boiling up in their ranks. They're saying it's not about that. It's not about how Republicans address it. It's about Democrats, as they say, you know, going for a power grab to remove another member from a committee. So there is an attempt by Republicans to shift the conversation away from where they are and who they are as a party.
I see. Although it appears that not all Republicans are on board with that argument, because we're speaking elsewhere on the program with former Republican Congressman Carlos Curbelo about the decision by Kevin McCarthy to not discipline Greene. And we asked him what it means for the Republican Party, and this is what he told us.
The Republican Party cannot offer the American people a clear and attractive alternative to the Democratic Party as long as they remain unable to commit to simple truths, to expressing obvious truths in public, like the fact that Joe Biden won the presidential election in 2020.
So, Kelsey, what do you make of what we just heard there from the former congressman? I mean, what does that tell us about this melee and the future of the Republican Party?
Well, the former Congressman Curbelo was, when he was serving, he was often at odds with President Trump. He has been saying since before he lost that election that he thought that the Republican Party needed to move in a direction that was more inclusive of conflicting ideas, that was more honest with people. He has long felt that the party is splitting and has wanted to move in a very different direction. And he's not alone. But the thing that we are not seeing is a lot of people speaking up from the Republican Party publicly about what that path forward would look like and who would lead. For now, it is still a conversation about President Trump and his relationship with the Republican Party.
I see. And for now, Curbelo's voice is still an outside one because he's a former congressman. That's NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell. Thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
There's new data out this week from the CDC showing that less than 5.5% of Americans who've been vaccinated for COVID-19 are black. Health experts say that number should be much higher, considering that black Americans make up 13% of the population. Joining us now to unpack some of the reasons for the shortfall is Dr. Georges Benjamin, head of the American Public Health Association. Dr. Benjamin, welcome to Here and Now.
Peter, glad to be here.
And your group is focused on improving public health equity. So when you look at those numbers, what do they mean to you?
You know, it tells me the tragedy that we haven't learned our lesson. You know, we know that these health inequities occur. We understand why they occur generally. We saw these inequities for the testing, and we had time to fix these problems before we really got to vaccinating people, and we just haven't done it yet.
Why not?
You know, everyone's being busy, and they're not focusing on the right things. I think that we've always said that it's important to address those populations most at risk, and now we need to pivot. And so my organization, like many others, are pushing very hard for us to make that pivot, because otherwise we're not going to save lives as quickly as we can.
Well, as you have just said, we have known for a while now about the inequities of this pandemic, including the fact that black and brown Americans are far more likely to die from COVID-19. But what is behind the fact that we now know they are also far less likely to be vaccinated?
Well, you know, we do have these historical hesitancies because of mistrust of government, mistrust in many ways of the healthcare system. And we should have done a lot more to educate the public earlier in the year, when we knew we were ramping up to give people vaccinations. We didn't do that. But the other part is more structural. I mean, we talk a lot about hesitancy, and hesitancy is an issue. But right now, a lot of the disparity is due to the way we've just structured access to the vaccine and how people are notified of when to get it.
I mean, it takes resources. For one, just to sign up for an appointment means you need a computer, and you also need the time, and you need to be savvy to negotiate with our pretty clunky systems so far. I mean, what about that? How much is that driving the problem?
When you only have the ability to go online and sign up, that's a problem. People ought to be able to call in and not have to wait, you know, 20 minutes to get someone to answer the phone to schedule an appointment. But I also have to tell you that if the place to go get your vaccination isn't in your community, or you have to take two buses and walk five blocks to get there, that's another problem. And again, this is not rocket science, and this is not the barriers that we have not yet known exist. We've known these barriers exist for years. So putting these vaccination centers in the community, making sure that we reach out to communities more assertively, proactively, to make sure they can get in line when it's their turn to get in line, is the way to resolve these inequities.
The Biden administration that just this week said that it's going to start sending some vaccines to pharmacies. Will that help get those shots and those doses into the community, like you're saying?
It will to some degree. You know, we learned from the West Virginia experience that getting these vaccines in locally is important. But, you know, we have pharmacy deserts in our country. We have places where even a pharmacy that is given the vaccine doesn't exist in communities. So we're also going to have to take vans into communities with the vaccine. We're going to have to go into some of the churches and some of the community centers and do the vaccinations right down the street from where people live.
Another issue is that many states are not even reporting data on who exactly is getting vaccinated. So how do we know how big the problem is if the numbers aren't there, if the data is incomplete?
You know, what gets measured gets done. And you're right, we're not getting the right data. There are data lags. There are just data. People aren't filling out all the boxes. And we just have to do a better job of that. By the way, we had that same problem with the testing. Now, part of it is also because we just have this clunky, antiquated, you know, data collection system for public health. You know, we're still collecting data on fax machines and sending it around, on paper-based systems and sending it around. That's going to require money and thoughtfulness to build those systems. But in the short term, we ought to be able to go in these communities and get people vaccinated. We ought to stress the importance of collecting the data. And if there are any legal or bureaucratic barriers, we need to remove those so we can actually count correctly who's getting vaccinated by race, ethnicity, and I would add by occupation, because, you know, we have a lot of people who in certain occupations that are extraordinarily high risk. And unless we start looking at occupation as well, we're going to miss some people.
from a public health perspective, doctor, what are the consequences of an inequitable system for vaccinations? What does that mean for all of us?
It means higher morbidity and mortality, meaning more people get sick and more people will die until you get everybody vaccinated. And the problem is when you miss very, very high-risk individuals, it costs us all. It costs us time. It costs us heartache. It costs us money. And then you remove all of those wonderful people from our society who can contribute. It impacts all of us.
Dr. Georges Benjamin, Executive Director of the American Public Health Association. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Actor Viggo Mortensen has 3 Academy Award nominations for his performances on screen, but he makes his debut as a director with his new film, Falling. Mortensen also wrote the screenplay and stars as John, a middle-aged man who has a troubled and sometimes violent relationship with his father, Willis. The family connections are strained even further as Willis begins to show signs of dementia. As the film opens, Willis and John are on an airplane when Willis, played by Lance Henriksen, gets trapped inside the lavatory and forgets where he is.
Pull, Dad.
Dad, you can't smoke in here.
Let's let your mother sleep for a while. It's very early.
Good idea.
Falling will open in theaters and on demand tomorrow. Viggo Mortensen joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to hear your voice.
And it's not really an autobiographical film, but I do understand that it comes from some of your own experiences. Can you tell me about that?
Well, there are some things in this family story that are taken directly from my childhood and adolescence, memories, but also from the recent past, and that's the issue of dementia, which both my parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, both sides of the family. There's been a lot of that, so I'm familiar with it and wanted to depict that respectfully and accurately, which is not always the case in movies. I started writing it after my mom's funeral. I just wanted to remember her. I wanted to keep images of her and my feelings about her as much as anything alive. And I ended up writing a fictional family story using some real elements, at least from my own subjective memories. And that's how I ended up writing it. In the process of writing and casting it and making the movie, editing it, and even talking now to you, I guess I'm keeping my feelings for my parents, especially my mother, alive. So I guess I succeeded in that.
Yeah. Can you tell me more about the way you wanted to depict this family that is in the grips of dementia? And I say that because it sort of happens to the entire family, doesn't it? And you say that you haven't seen that depicted all the time in a respectful way. What do you mean by that? And what did you try to do?
Or just completely accurate. I think some movies, even good ones, they can't make up their minds, for one thing. Why are we at the beginning of the disease, the middle stages, the end stages? They're kind of trying to throw everything at the wall. But the main thing that I find is that a lot of those depictions, even the best ones, are mostly showing someone who's confused a lot of the time. And my experience is that the people who are confused are the observers, sometimes the caregivers, not that person. That person really is gradually seeing and hearing and feeling these things. It's very real for them in the present, regardless of how strange it may seem to you or inexplicable. So that's one thing I think we did get right, the way it's written, by how we use sound and image. And also, fortunately, because we have an incredible actor giving the performance of his lifetime, in my opinion, Lance Henriksen, is the way he subtly goes in and out of different mental states, the way he reacts to people, and the way he tackled head on without ever trying to, play to the audience. He gave a very realistic portrayal of that disease and of a particular kind of person who was troubled even before the disease,
You are absolutely right. All of the acting in the film is strong, but Lance Henriksen really, really steals the show. How did he prepare for that? And how did you help prepare him for that?
We got to know each other really well, and we worked on the script a lot. And, he asked me questions, and about dementia, and I talked about it and tried to help him as many ways as I could. I wasn't intending to act in the movie at first. You know, I play, as you know, his son in the story. And those are the two main characters we see, you know, the ones we see most of the time. It's this sort of battle, psychological battle between them in a way, the story. It's the tail end of a lifetime of conflict and spotty communication. And it's, I guess I want to explore that as well. What are the limits of communication, especially when you're dealing with someone that doesn't seem to want to communicate with you or seems to see the world in a completely different way than you do?
Well, here's another clip from the film. This is Lance Henriksen working on a crossword puzzle.
What's the slang word for overactive? It's five letters. The second one might be a Y.
How many letters?
Five.
Hyper.
I wanted to mention this scene because it's one of the rare times when Willis isn't yelling, and it is so painful to watch him throughout the course of this film in relentless conflict with his family. Mm-hmm. That at times, you know, as I watch it, I just wanted to run away from that conflict. Maybe that says something about my own personality, but I think that's probably something that you were trying to make the audience feel.
Yeah, we were. And I understand what you're saying. And I think that some younger reviewers and maybe audience members or, you know, people that have not had experience with taking care of an older person or a difficult person, it's easy to say, well, you know, that person that I know at work or a friend, they're no longer my friend. I can't talk to them anymore. I don't like what they're saying. I don't like the way they treat me. That's it. I'm done. Sever it. And some of those people might watch this movie and go, well, who wants to listen to that crap? I don't have to listen to that. I'm walking away. But in life, that does happen. And sometimes it is your father or your mother. And you have to make a decision. I'm not telling anybody what to do. I'm just posing questions. I'm saying, this is what's happening in this family. And it's probably happening in a lot of other families. How do you deal with it? If you want to walk away, you can. Everybody has to make their own decision. If you don't walk away, it is a minefield, and it is difficult, and it tries your patience. But in the end, it can be rewarding. There might be a glimpse. There's no guarantee, but there might be a glimmer of empathy there.
Viggo Mortensen, let's go through some of your credits on this film. You starred in it on screen, obviously. You wrote it. You directed it in your directorial debut, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in addition to all that, you even wrote the score for this film. Let's listen to a little of that. Tell me about making the music for this film.
Well, I really enjoyed that. It's, you know, that's one of the more noticeable pieces. You know, it's an interlude where the old man Willis has escaped, and people are like, where the hell is he gone now? And he's gone to the beach, and he's just enjoying himself while the family's going crazy looking for him all over the city. But most of the score is discreet. It's piano based, with a few pieces by my longtime friend and collaborator Buckethead, who's a legendary guitar player.
He's a shred guitar player, right? He's not shredding in this film.
No, but he can do anything. He's an amazing musician. And we've made a lot of records over the years. I had never edited a movie, like images, but I found from my experience editing the music that we've made together over the years that it wasn't that different. It's really about timing, tempo, rhythm, you know, finding the right mix of images and the right flow. It wasn't that different from making music.
Gosh, you're a writer, you're a poet, you're a musician, you're an actor, you're a director. I don't think people realize how many things you can do.
Well, I don't assume that people are going to like any or all of the things I do. I just like to do them. But I've always liked in movie storytelling, I just like the collective aspect of it and what a complete universe it is creatively. You know, I don't really separate any of those things. It all feels like telling the story, you know, from thinking of the idea, writing the script, shooting it, and you're sort of rewriting it again, editing it, doing the music. I really enjoy that whole process.
You know, when I listen back to that music again, it just reminds me of this other point that I was thinking about upon watching it. The film is so tense and it is so full of conflict, as we already had talked about for so long, until the very end when it breaks and it calms down and it goes quiet. And in doing so, I mean, I think you take our breaths away in some ways. Tell me about that strategy.
It's not like there's a full resolution. It's not like some, I don't know, studio movie where the old guy breaks down and cries and apologizes to everyone. You know, that's not going to happen. But there is a certain amount of acceptance on both their parts, accepting each other the way they are. And there's a kind of an unspoken deal made between them. So peace does come, and it frees Willis up to see his first wife, my mother, maybe in a different way, with an open heart for the first time in years. And it also allows me to see my mother and my father, to remember them happy and connecting, that something must have been good at some point. Something must have been right. Otherwise, why would they have got together? Why would they have had two kids? You know, all of that happens.
Well, Viggo Mortensen, I know you have this reputation as being an actual nice person, and I can hear it in talking to you, and I can see it in this film as well. And your parents had to have something to do with that, I think. So Viggo Mortensen,
absolutely.
Writer, director, actor, and composer for the new film Falling. Thank you so much.
Thank you for talking to me.
Here's more of the music from Falling. And if you're wishing we had asked Viggo Mortensen about his time on Lord of the Rings, well, we did. And you can hear him talk about it at hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, February 9th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
We are still in the middle of this pandemic, and right now, having science news you can trust, from variants to vaccines, is essential. NPR Shortwave has your back. About 10 minutes every weekday, listen and subscribe to Shortwave, the daily science podcast from NPR.
In Columbus, Ohio, a former police officer is facing a murder charge in the shooting death of a black man last December. Officer Adam Coy shot and killed Andre Hill about 10 seconds after he encountered him in a neighbor's garage. Coy said he thought Hill had a gun, but really, he was just holding a cell phone. Coy and the other officer on the scene did not turn on their body cameras until after the shooting. They also failed to render aid to Hill. Here's Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost at a press conference yesterday.
Truth is the best friend of justice. And the grand jury here found the truth. Andre Hill should not be dead.
Earlier this week, the Columbus City Council unanimously passed Andre's Law, which would require officers to turn their body cameras on as soon as they get out of their vehicles. It would also require officers to administer aid after use of force. Joining us now is Columbus City Council President Shannon Hardin. Mr. Hardin, first of all, your reaction to Adam Coy's indictment, was it the right call?
Well, it was certainly the right call, Peter. This is partial justice for Andre Hill, and I say that because an indictment does not mean conviction, and secondly, because Andre Hill should still be with us today. And so I'm thinking about his family and our community who lost a good man unnecessarily to police violence.
Well, speaking of his family, soon after Andre Hill was killed, his daughter Carissa was the one who called for legislation that would ensure that this never happens to anybody else. Do you think Andre's Law fulfills her call?
I spoke at Mr. Hill's funeral, and I promised Carissa and Shauna and his grandbabies that we would get this done. And in about 35 days, we passed this bill unanimously. And we also strengthened parts of it. So the family wanted to make sure that, yes, if you show up to a scene, that you turn on the body-worn cameras. Secondly, the inhumane actions of allowing someone to lay on the ground and die without doing the other part of their sworn duty in terms of preserving life was unacceptable. So we also found that that could be a criminal charge, not just a disciplinary charge. And any time that a police call comes out that there has been an officer-involved shooting, the call taker is now instructed to call and send medical transport to the scene, regardless of if a police officer makes the call or not. That is all trying to make sure that there is some justice in this case, that this family knows that Andre Hill's legacy lives on, and that we don't have another Andre Hill in Columbus. This is the work of police reform, and this council is committed to even more police reform, because we need to make sure that regardless of where you live, and certainly whatever the color of your skin, that you know you'll get the adequate and competent response when you are in your hour of need.
Oh, with respect, some of those changes seem so basic. I mean, this yes. death could have been prevented if those laws were already on the books. I mean, why weren't the police already required to do something as simple as offer aid if they shoot somebody? And why didn't they have to already turn on their body cameras as soon as they got out of their cars?
You know, I think this speaks to the issue of why we're having these conversations for reform. And I would admit that in many large cities like Columbus, we did not heed those calls for reform early enough. And so, you know, we are living in a moment of time brought to us by the folks that took to the streets and by the families that said enough is enough, that gave us the political space and the will of the people to actually get these sweeping reforms done that will hopefully keep folks safe going forward.
Shannon Hardin is president of the Columbus City Council in Ohio. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Earlier this week, we checked in on Ohio as the state rolls out the first coronavirus vaccinations for teachers. One of the first places to get the vaccine was Youngstown. Amy Savage has been teaching kindergarten for more than 20 years at St. Christine's, a Catholic school there. She got the first dose of the vaccine on Monday and joins us now. Amy, welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And, you know, some people have described their first dose as feeling like a weight has been lifted off their shoulders. How do you feel?
I feel that exact way. I'm very excited to, you know, I feel like I have protection, and it's feeling good.
And did that sort of line up with the way all of your colleagues felt as well, or was there some schism there?
We were about 50%, 50-50. We had some hesitant, you know, due to different beliefs, and but we're all here for the safety of our children, so we are hoping that we made good choices.
I understand that even before you got the vaccine, you've been teaching in person this year, and I wonder how your students are dealing with the pandemic. You know, I've got one kindergartner, Amy. I don't know how you explain a public health crisis to a classroom full of them.
It's our parents have been fabulous. We had been out of school since March, so my new friends that came in, I teach kindergarten, you know, their parents did a wonderful job just letting them know that even though there is a pandemic, as long as you are being safe and wearing your mask and sanitizing, they've been doing a phenomenal job at handling it.
Did you have basically full in-person enrollment, or did you have some teachers, or some parents, I should say, who held their students out?
We had some parents who held their students out. I, in my particular class, had two students who had parents with underlying conditions. But we would Zoom with them on Fridays. Some of the older grades Zoom on a daily basis with their children because of the attention span. But here in kindergarten, we did as best as we can to make contact with our friends who were virtual.
I understand you did more of the virtual schooling at the end of last school year, right at the sort of outset of many lockdowns. And I'm curious if you can compare and contrast. You sort of mentioned earlier that the attention span is hard for kindergartners. I mean, is there any replacing the in-school experience?
There really, it's not an easy replacement. When we left in March, we had a rapport with the kids, so it was a little bit easier to interact with them and get them into the learning mode. When we started this year, we didn't really have that rapport yet, so it was a little more difficult to build it through the video than in person. So that took a little while longer to get accustomed to that.
So since you came back to the classroom this school year, have you had any major outbreaks within the school? You mentioned some of the precautions that you were taking earlier.
We have not. We have been very lucky. Many of our outbreaks have been up more in junior high with the like 7th and 8th graders, teenagers who maybe are not following as closely. But down in our primary hall, which is kinder through 3rd, our students have been fantastic. They are always wearing their masks. We have our plexiglass around us, and we are constantly sanitizing.
So it sounds like you have felt pretty comfortable this year with the precautions within the school building. And of course, now you've had the vaccine. But there are a lot of teachers across the country who don't feel that way. We've seen some high profile protests about safety concerns. In Chicago, for example, there's a showdown between the teachers union and city officials. And a big part of that is about their desire to get vaccinated before going back to the classroom. So, you know, you've been in this profession for a couple of decades. I'm curious what you think about that. I mean, do you support colleagues in your profession who say they just don't feel comfortable going back to the classroom until they get the shot?
I do support them because I myself in August felt very nervous. I have, you know, parents at home and grandparents, and I wanted to make sure that we all kept safe and that I wasn't bringing anything home to them. But as I got to school, and our school did a great job with the masking and providing shields and providing the appropriate PPR that we needed, but yeah, I can see where, you know, other colleagues, if they don't have that support and have those resources available to them, it could be scary.
Do you feel like it's part of your responsibility now as one of the early recipients to kind of evangelize among your colleagues?
Yes, I do. About half of our staff took it, so we have half that are actually waiting to see how those of us that got it are reacting to it, and I feel great, and I am going to encourage them to also join us.
Amy, you said your students have adapted pretty well to a different classroom environment, to say the least, and they've even been sort of holding each other accountable for washing hands and wearing masks. How do those conversations go among kindergartners?
Well, they're quite easy. If somebody's mask is down, they'll simply say, "Mary, pull your mask up." If they're too close, they'll say, "Could you stand back a little?" They react to each other and they do it.
It's actually a good life skill to learn to, you know, sort of gently correct and have potentially awkward conversations with your peers.
Absolutely. But they also do listen to us teachers. So they take our word as gold. So I try to be as positive and encouraging that, you know, together we're going to get through this. And if we all help each other, we will get better sooner.
Well, Amy Savage, we're glad that you're back in the classroom and that you've had your coronavirus vaccine. And we appreciate your time with us. That's Amy Savage, who teaches in Youngstown, Ohio, and who got her vaccine on Monday. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, and I wish everybody else out there good luck, and get out there and get your vaccine.
In California, the number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 is down more than 50% in the past 2 weeks, but nearly every county in California is colored purple on the state's color-coded map, indicating the highest level of risk. NPR's Netta Ulaby wondered why purple became a worse color, an even scarier color, than the more traditional red.
Turn on TV news in California, you'll hear purple tier, purple tier.
And the purple tier is what we were in before we...
As you see the map there, purple tier sports are allowed to play.
Sure. So I think we're going to be in purple for a bit.
What it would take to get San Diego from the purple into the less restrictive red tier...
That's the Fox, ABC, and PBS channels in San Diego. Red means the daily COVID caseload is substantial. Purple is worse. It means widespread. This makes sense to Georgia Lupi. She's an information designer. Her job is to take hard data and translate it into images that are easier for our brains to process, using tools like color. Traditionally, she says,
red is the color of alert, of danger, of stop signs, and purple is the next color in the spectrum from yellow to orange to red.
Purple carries some positive associations, like royalty. But the color, says Lupi, is also dark, livid.
Think about bruises and the color purple on skin when talking about a disease.
I asked the California Department of Public Health, why purple? They emailed saying the COVID color tiers are based on the same ones used for air quality.
The air quality color will be red tomorrow.
Californians know what those colors mean after so many wildfires.
Then Coco might get sick again.
That's a PSA from the Environmental Protection Agency, where scientist Susan Stone has worked for decades. She was there when the EPA came up with a color-coded air quality index during a conference in the late 90s with health and environmental advocates, state, local, and tribal officials.
It was funny. I was a health scientist, and I was just totally surprised that colors was the topic that really blew the whole discussion up. They were getting so heated that we were saying, we need to call a break because otherwise people are going to start shoving each other.
Back then, Stone says, the idea of using even red for air quality was somewhat theoretical.
It looked like at the time, looking back at the data, that if we were to put red at hazardous, it would never occur.
So red became unhealthy, not hazardous, and the color next on the spectrum, purple, was for alerts. Just think, Stone says, of how different things were only 20 years ago.
These were the days in the late 90s and early 2000s before the huge wildfires out west. So it was extremely rare to get into the hazardous range.
The EPA thought purple might never be used. Now, even purple is not bad enough. The very, very worst color is maroon, partly because black does not read well on maps and you can't see the borders. Still, purple clearly indicates a royal mess. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
After a trying year for sports, we've almost made it to Super Bowl Sunday. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers go up against the Kansas City Chiefs this weekend. Veteran Tom Brady faces the young record breaker, Patrick Mahomes. The Chiefs have a chance to win their second championship in a row, but Brady could snatch a seventh Super Bowl ring and victory for the usually terrible Bucks. Mike Pesca joins us now. He's here now as sports analyst and host of the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, the big game is in Tampa on Sunday. It's the first time that a team has played on its home turf, although they won't have the full home crowd advantage. But right. How do the Bucks stack up against the Chiefs in this championship game?
Well, home field advantage is at least is at least in play a bit, and it's not even so much that the stadium won't be filled with 70,000 people, but instead something closer to 20,000 people. I have noticed, by the way, that when you space these people out, it means that the stands in front of them are empty and they get to bang on the seats. So in a way, half a crowd is just as loud as a whole crowd, just because of the availability of the material for banging. But I do think, I mean, I'm over the moon about the Chiefs. I think the Chiefs offense is amazing. I almost said Wall Street because it seems like that, but Las Vegas agrees with me. The odds makers have set the Chiefs at about a field goal favorite. But beyond that, 60% of the money that has been bet is on the Chiefs, which sometimes makes me a little nervous. If something is so publicly popular, maybe the smart guys see an angle and an argument for the Bucks that I'm not seeing, since I'm, you know, I know something about football, but not so much more than the people who set the odds at Vegas. But the Chiefs offense is just so amazing.
I like the counterintuitive thinking there. As a long time Tom Brady fan myself, Mike, and I can understand the mix-up, because I feel like if Patrick Mahomes were a stock, he'd be smashing IPO records. He smashed a lot of other records, right? I mean, he's one of the highest paid athletes in the world. But Tom Brady is playing in his 10th Super Bowl here, Mike. So who do you think has the edge in this QB matchup?
Well, experience-wise, you'd say Brady. He is the GOAT, the greatest of all time. But the season that Patrick Mahomes put together is just as good, if not better, than what Tom Brady did, as is last season. So there's no advantage. In fact, these are, in a way, and how you look at it, the two best players at the most important position in sports. Patrick Mahomes, just in physical gifts, and he also sees the game well. And Tom Brady, in experience, the absolute inability to ever be flustered. He came back against the Falcons in an almost impossible game. You will never get him out of the game mentally. That's as intriguing an aspect of this game as anything else.
I believe there's like 283 diamonds right on those Super Bowl rings to commemorate the 28-3 deficit that they came back from, right? So, and speaking of
not subtle,
big numbers,
that's not
there,
DeMarco.
Yeah, I know, right? So how about, you know, off the field, Mike? I mean, you mentioned that it's going to be basically a half full stadium, 25,000 fans. What's the NFL doing to stage this game safely in the middle of a pandemic?
Well, they are doing that. And of those fans, a significant portion are first responders that the NFL has invited to the game. So there will be spacing. There will be masks. If you've watched NFL games, you know the masks often fall down around the nose. And then we do crowd shots and people aren't masked well. But Raymond James Stadium is an outdoor stadium, which is incredibly significant. So it's not so much different than most of the other playoff games that have been played in outdoor stadiums this year.
Got it. Well, we're all looking forward to a little bit of a release on Super Bowl Sunday. But before you go, Mike, I do want to ask you a little about basketball, because we do want to note the passing of the legendary college basketball coach, John Chaney, who spent decades building Temple University into a national power. What is his legacy on the game?
Oh, he was a legend, and a legend meaning he has this fantastic resume with over 500 wins at Temple and hundreds of wins before he even got there. And he took a small, somewhat beleaguered school and by dint of his personality forged them into, if not the best team in college basketball every year, the biggest nightmare in college basketball. He knew that he couldn't recruit the best guys, and he knew that Temple didn't have the best facilities. Their stadium was underground, and you began sweating as soon as you entered their gym, and the image of John Chaney screaming in his raspy voice on the sidelines with huge armpit stains, that is part of the legend. But when I say they were the team that you wanted to play least, whenever they would do a tournament preview and Temple would almost always make it, even if they weren't a number two or three or four seed, people would point to them and say they are such a nightmare. They play such hard defense. They are just tougher than everyone else in college basketball. And that's John Chaney. That is a reflection of his personality. That is a reflection of his force of will. He was a legendary character and an excellent coach, and the game will be poorer for his absence.
Well, and you're giving me flashbacks with the imagery of John Chaney with the sweaty armpits. The thing I'll always remember, Mike, is you could tell how tense the game was based on the tie, right? Because as the game would tense up here, the tie would get lower and lower as he loosened it until it was practically dragging on the floor. Mike Pesca is here now as a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.